disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please consider supporting us. Head on over to www.co-fi.com/deadsouls and donate a few bucks to our research and investigations. We truly appreciate all your support and you helping us out. For show updates, you can also find us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Podcast and we'll come up. This is Investigating the Freedmans, Secrets and Panic. Tonight we are heading to Great Neck, Long Island, New York. I write to inform you that none of the events allegedly described by or attributed to Kenneth Doe ever took place. The letter to the Nassau County District Attorney's Office was concise, synoptic, and entirely unambiguous. The letter was from a man in his 30s who wished to remain anonymous. He was referring to his role in a 1988 criminal investigation where he was one of a number of children whose allegations of sexual abuse sent three men to prison. The case in turn triggered a panic amongst the thousands of residents in the small Long Island community of Great Neck and its surrounding villages. The Freedman family, at the heart of the criminal investigation, logged their self-destruction in home videos throughout the arrest, investigation, and trial, and the result of those home videos can be seen in the 2003 Oscar-nominated HBO documentary Capturing the Freedmans, which was directed by Andrew Jarecki. In the letter, the gentleman stated that neither Arnold nor Jesse Freedman had sexually molested him, touched him inappropriately, or showed him pictures of naked people. So first, let's get an overview on the case. The Freedman family lived at 17 Piccadilly Road in Great Neck, Long Island, an upper middle class affluent town that was the image of American suburbia, tree-lined streets, white picket fences, and multiple car families. Arnold Freedman and his wife Elaine had lived in the house for over 20 years and had raised all three of their sons in the home. David was the eldest. He's a performing children's party clown and was born in 1963. Seth, the middle child, born in 1966, is somewhat rebellious and sarcastic. The younger son Jesse, who was born in 1970, is described by friends and family as a goofy, fun, and caring pussycat. The three sons and their father Arnie shared the same silly slapstick dad humor and had a fantastic rapport and close relationship. Arnold and Elaine, unfortunately, by the late 1980s, had drifted apart and their marriage was cold and distant. Elaine was somewhat jealous of the relationship that Arnie had with the boys. However, due to mental health issues and postnatal depression on her part, Elaine never really had close relationships with her children. She was seen as cold, negative, and uncaring, the boys would describe. The investigation into the Freedman family, or specifically the father and head of the family Arnold and his younger son 18-year-old Jesse, began in 1987. The United States Postal Service had intercepted a magazine of child pornography which was sent to Arnold from the Netherlands. The Postal Service made its discovery known to federal authorities, who began to look at Arnold. On November the 3rd, 1987, federal investigators executed a search of the Freedman home in Great Neck, Long Island. The search finds approximately 20 illegal pornographic magazines, but no evidence of any self-produced pornography. During the search of the property, they also find a list of student names who attend Arnold Freedman's after-school computer classes. Remember, this was 1987. Arnold was a qualified and award-winning high school teacher by profession, it should be known. His computer classes were taught out of his home basement during weekday evenings. He also taught piano and music lessons from the home in after-school hours. His tuition was very popular in the community. Federal agents informed the Nassau County Police Department of the search on the Freedman's home. This triggers Detective Sergeant Fran Galasso of the Sex Crimes Unit to initiate an investigation into possible child sexual abuse in Arnold Friedman's computer classes. There have been no complaints of abuse from children or parents. No parent has reported physical or psychological symptoms of abuse either. 81 student names were confiscated by federal agents during their initial search of the Friedman house. These student names are passed to the police. The police then begin to interview the children, looking for evidence of crimes. Detectives would initially interview over 30 children. None of them had disclosed any sexual abuse, with most saying nothing happened at all. Some of the children allege that they'd been subjected to physical and sexual abuse from Arnold and Jesse, who assisted Arnold with the classes. Arnold and Jesse are arrested on November the 25th, 1987, on charges of child sexual abuse. The news quickly spreads around the small town, and the community descends into chaos. A number of local parent meetings are organized within the town, and as well as concerned parents, also in attendance of the meetings were Sandra Kaplan, Chief of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Professor at Cornell Medical College, Detective Fran Galasso, and Assistant District Attorney Joseph Honorato. A number of false accusations and theories are thrown around, and case information is illegally and inappropriately shared with the families by the police and district attorney, including an accusation by DA Honorato that he believed there were as many as 500 children who had been abused, even though the class only ever had a maximum of 81 students. This led to an atmosphere of guilt, anger, and indignation on the Friedman's part before any trial or evidence had been collected. The defense labeled the case as an unsubstantiated witch hunt. The two men were eventually released on bail and returned home to prepare for court. They hoped for acquittal, confident in the lack of physical evidence against them and certain the charges would be proven to be false. Further, reports began growing in local press of coercive tactics and leading questions being used to question the students by investigators. In June 1988, Ross Goldstein, a close friend of Jesse, is arrested for alleged involvement in the child molestation incidents at the computer classes. Sergeant Galasso calls Goldstein a homosexual partner of Jesse's, something which they both denied. They stated that they just smoked pot together occasionally. Police also alleged that the Friedmans were operating a sex ring out of their basement and that more men were involved. There are initially 8 child complainants discovered by police, but this rises to 17 by October 1988. On May 13, 1988, Arnold Friedman pleads guilty to all charges against him and is sentenced to 10 to 30 years in prison on state charges. In September 1988, Ross Goldstein signs a cooperation agreement with authorities agreeing to testify against Jesse Friedman. Police encourage Goldstein to take the agreement, as it means he will only serve 6 months in prison and he will be charged as a youth offender, meaning his record will be sealed upon release. On December 20th, 1988, Jesse Friedman pleads guilty to all charges following the testimony of all claimants and evidence presented by his friend Ross Goldstein. Jesse is sentenced to 6 to 18 years in prison in January 1989. In February 1985, Arnold Friedman takes an overdose of antidepressants, which causes a fatal heart attack whilst incarcerated at Collins Correctional Facility in New York. He has a life insurance policy that pays out $250,000 to its sole beneficiary, Jesse Friedman. On December 7th, 2001, after 13 years in prison and having been denied parole 4 times, Jesse Friedman is released from prison to 5 years of parole supervision. Okay. So with all that in mind, the case seems pretty cut and dry, right? Well, as always, it isn't quite that straightforward or transparent. Jumping back to that letter from the witness we are calling Kenneth Doe, the letter went on and described how he had never observed either Arnold nor Jesse engaging in anything, and I quote, even remotely akin to sexual misconduct, close quote. Doe had no reason to believe that any such acts had occurred. What he did recall clearly was that the police repeatedly came to his home to question him and would not leave until he provided them with an account of sexual abuse that they wanted. As a result, his letter said, I guess I just folded so that they would leave me alone. Kenneth Doe is one of the several key figures involved in this case who have recanted or disputed parts of the accusations which were attributed to them in the Freedman investigation. Five of the original 17 children who accused the Freedmans have since recanted. The most dramatic development in the case is the statement of Mr. Goldstein, the former friend of Jesse Freedman, who also became a suspect, was charged and sentenced to 13 months in jail as part of a cooperation deal. The judge actually ignored part of the deal and sentenced him to longer than was agreed anyway. Mr. Goldstein, now a professional musician based in New York City, was the only person charged other than the two Freedmans. The police decided not to pursue two other individuals who were friends of Jesse's and who they allege was involved in the sex ring. Goldstein's confession helped convince Jesse Freedman that he had no other choice but to plead guilty, and that he was the only person, other than the children, who was said to have witnessed the crimes at the computer classes. He did not participate in the Capture in the Freedman's documentary, and he has largely remained out of the spotlight and away from any attempts to exonerate Jesse Freedman. Mr. Goldstein has been silent regarding the case for 35 years. In 2010, he provided investigators with a 9-page statement and made a video-recorded testimony which lasted for more than 3 hours when the district attorney, Kathleen Rice, announced her consent to the opinion of the circuit court and agreed to organize a conviction review in regards to Jesse Freedman's incarceration. This occurred following her statement in August of that year that, and I quote, "The record here suggests a reasonable likelihood that Jesse Freedman was wrongfully convicted." Ross Goldstein has gone on record to say that he was coerced into making a false confession and coached by the police on the facts of the case. He also stated that he went along with the police's story to avoid a draconian and lengthy prison sentence himself. Instead, he was offered a 6-month sentence as a youthful offender and for his criminal record to be sealed upon his release. He ultimately served 13 months before being freed. He has declined to comment publicly since. The case is a convoluted one in that there is more than one crime here. It is undeniable that Arnold Freedman received and distributed child pornography at the family home between 1984 and 1987. When his home was initially raided following a tip-off from the United States Postal Service, the authorities found around 20 magazines and a number of pornographic computer games. The search warrant produced a few other pornographic materials, namely 3 reels of 8mm film. This was all in Arnold's home and located in the basement room he used to conduct his computer classes. The initial search of the Freedman home manifested into somewhat of a circus. Arnold was arrested initially before Elaine came home after being shopping and immediately flew off the handle and began with what witnesses say was a very hostile screaming match between her and the lead investigator, Sergeant Fran Galasso. Elaine thought the search brought shame on the family and attempted to call her lawyer. When the police stopped her from picking up her telephone and she reacted with rage, they arrested her too for interfering with the search. The older son, David, also arrived at the home during the search and attempted to thwart the search by placing his underwear on his head and shouting, "I'm an asshole, look at me," repeatedly at the police. Later down the line, Arnold did in fact admit to his lawyer and after his incarceration, on record, that he had abused 2 other children prior to the computer class arrest. Both children, he said, were the children of family friends. Arnold also stated that he abused his own brother Howard when he was 13 and his brother was 7 years old. A side note on this one, this is something Howard has denied and claimed that he has no memory of. Arnold had written a letter to his lawyer in 1990, which stated that when he was around 4 years old, his older sister died of a blood disorder at the age of 6. This death tore the family apart and his father left. Ultimately, Arnold was raised by his mother, who survived on welfare and from support from mail callers who would visit the one-room apartment that they lived in. Arnie stated that he regularly watched his mother have sex with these men at a young age, and it was witnessing these acts which caused him to copy them with his younger brother and warped his sense of right from wrong. Arnold did, however, state that he categorically did not abuse any of the children in the computer class, and by that point in his life, his mid-50s, that sort of behaviour was years behind him. It is also a fact that the Nassau County Police, under the direction of Sergeant Fran Galasso, head of the county's sex crimes unit, began questioning and looking for children and crimes as a reaction to panic amongst parents within the community. Detective Anthony Segulia of the Nassau County Sex Crimes Unit stated on camera in 2003 that he had to use leading and coercively intimidating questions on the child victims in order to get them to admit the crimes happened. Ultimately, 17 students, boys between 8 and 10 years of age, testified to being subjected to abuse that was said to have taken place in front of other students committed by Arnold, Jesse, and Ross Goldstein, and two other unnamed men who were never arrested or charged. Sergeant Galasso described the computer classes as, and I quote, a sexual free-for-all. Additionally, she went on, the children would be screaming, crying, and their clothes would be soiled with blood and semen. The children were very fearful. The specific allegations included a game of naked leapfrog where the children were anally raped as Arnold, Jesse, and Ross leapt over the children who were bent in a row around the computer desks in the crowded room. One boy specifically claimed 56 instances of sodomy in a 10-week period at once weekly classes. Another 8-year-old boy claimed he was forced to have anal sex with Jesse Friedman and Ross Goldstein in front of a full class of students. Other students claimed Arnold, Jesse, and Ross would perform sexual acts on the students and force the other students to watch this happen. All of the acts were photographed and videotaped, the claimants asserted, although no photographs or videos were ever found by authorities during their searches of the Friedman home. The appeals court characterized the allegations as increasingly bizarre, sadistic, and even logically implausible. Ron Georgialis was one of the computer class students, and he spoke positively about Arnold Friedman and the classes. He called the charges absurd and someone's crazy fantasy. He asked if there were in fact children screaming and crying and their clothes were so obviously soiled, why were the children so happy when their parents picked them up? Why, when parents showed up unannounced during the classes, was nothing going on other than computer lessons? Why were the children eager to re-sign up for more classes after their initial sessions? Eventually, Arnold and Jesse Friedman were indicted on 54 counts of sexual abuse and were arraigned before Judge Abby Boklin, a former sex crime prosecutor. Ross Goldstein, in testifying against Jesse, would reduce any sentence or punishment he got and turned state's witness in order to save himself from further involvement. Was this a move by prosecutors to strengthen a case against Jesse, who they had little to no evidence against, other than heavily coerced child witnesses, of course? The defense thinks so. Arnold Friedman was facing certain conviction on pornography charges, and he wanted to separate his son's case from his own, so he pleaded guilty to the abuse charges in exchange for a promised sentence of 10 to 30 years. It was after this was settled that he admitted to further historic sex crimes while in prison. But what about Jesse? Well, Jesse Friedman maintained his innocence for more than a year while on bail. He changed his mind after officials submitted a third indictment, this one charging him on 198 counts and following the confession of Mr. Goldstein. Facing a possible 50-year sentence, Jesse Friedman pleaded guilty in December 1988 to 25 counts of abuse. Authorities were concerned that he showed little to no remorse at the time. On the day of sentencing, Jesse was seen by police, prosecutors, victims' family members, and press singing, dancing, and performing comedy skits outside of the courthouse with his two brothers. This caused him to be subsequently attacked by the father of one of the children as he entered the court building. Jesse was given a sentence of 6 to 18 years in prison, and he served 13 years before being released in December 2001. After he was incarcerated, Jesse conducted an interview with Geraldo Rivera, where he also admitted to the crimes that he was accused of. You can listen to a small extract of that interview here.
How many kids, Jesse, did you and your father physically abuse in your home?
I guess 17.
17 different children?
17 children.
What did you do to the children?
What did I do to the children? I would fondle them. I was forced to pose in hundreds of photos and my father in all sorts of sexual positions with the kids. And the kids likewise with myself. oral sex going both ways. I was forced to pose with my penis against their anus. I would control the kids. I would keep them in line if class got too riled up.
Why didn't the kids ever tell?
The same reason I never told.
Did you threaten them, Jesse?
I told them that if they told anyone what was going on, that I knew terrible, terrible things would happen to all of us.
Filmmaker Andrzej Jarecki came across the Friedman story in 2003 while he was producing a separate documentary about Jesse's brother David. David Friedman was a professional party clown in New York City, also known as Silly Billy. He had told Jarecki about the case and what he considered to be a substantial miscarriage of justice, and Jarecki became interested in utilizing David's home movies from the time to form a documentary that showed a creepy allegory of suspect justice, family dysfunction, human frailty, and elusive truth. The film ended up confusing the situation and muddying the waters only further. The documentary has received criticism from detractors and accusers of the Friedmans. It left out mention of Jesse's confession on the Geraldo Rivera show. It also failed to include details of the Ross Goldstein arrest, confession, and charges. Detractors also criticized the movie for only interviewing around 5 of the 17 accusers, and only including 2 of those interviews in the finished movie. Jarecki has since said the ambiguity of the film reflected what he knew at the time. Since then, the case has become a cause for Andrew Jarecki, who has continued his investigation. He and his colleague Mark Smerling, who produced the film with Jarecki, have worked with Jesse's attorney, Ron Cuby, and have amassed over 1,700 pages of interviews and documentation, which they have turned over to the district attorney's office. These documents contributed to a 2010 re-evaluation of the Jesse Friedman conviction. Jarecki now says that it is clear to him that Jesse Friedman was wrongfully convicted in a hothouse of hysteria. So many of the accusers have recanted, and there is so much evidence of witness coercion and memory implantation through hypnosis. Well, let's talk about that. Firstly, let's remember that it's 1988. The climate of the time is heated around child molestation, and is a period slap bang in the middle of America's satanic panic, the moral outrage that gripped the nation and eventually spread worldwide. More than 12,000 accusations of satanic and ritual abuse were reported during this period, with significant evidence of police corruption and coercion tactics used to secure convictions. Many cases reached international notoriety, such as the Kern County child abuse scandal, the McMartin preschool trial, and the case of the West Memphis Three. The panic is credited to a 1980 book titled Michelle Remembers that has since been entirely discredited. The book talks about how Michelle Smith, who was suffering with serious depression in 1976, opted to undergo therapy to treat her condition. She underwent recovered memory therapy with Canadian psychiatrist Lawrence Pazder. The book documents how, over the course of 600 hours of therapy spread across 14 months, she recovered memories of being the victim of satanic ritual abuse at the hands of the Church of Satan. The recovered memory therapy used in Smith's account has now been entirely debunked by many psychology professionals, and is known to create false memories, which are in fact placed into the patient's subconscious as part of the therapy sessions. This is fairly significant in relation to the Friedman case too. In January 1988, a meeting of parents, law enforcement, and district attorneys gathered in Saddle Rock Elementary School. Also in attendance was Dr. Sandra Kaplan, the chief of child and adolescent psychiatry at Cornell Medical College. Kaplan mentioned during the meeting that all kids, victims or witnesses, should have an evaluation by a sexual abuse specialized person or team, then probably undergo a brief intervention of 6 psychiatry sessions. The children were subsequently enrolled in group therapy sessions at North Shore University Hospital. Of the 15 children seen in the two groups, 6 children had no memories of being victimized, even though other members of the class stated that they witnessed their abuse. A technique that helped these children remember what happened was having all the children draw pictures of the room where they were victimized, and then to speak about their memories of the classes using the pictures as visual aids. With the help of this technique, 2 of the children who had no memory of the abuse suddenly remembered most of the detail of their alleged victimization. 2 of the remaining 4 had vague but not detailed memories, and the remaining children continued to not remember their abuse at all. Dr. Sandra Kaplan gave an interview to the Great Neck Record newspaper at the time, stating, quote unquote, "The children I have seen who were victims seem to be very compassionate people, and, if anything, the concerns of these children are that they don't want to be responsible in any way." Quote unquote. This effectively asserts that those children who said that they had no memory of any abuse were saying, according to Kaplan, that because they didn't want to cause problems for the Friedman family, they didn't confirm any abuse. A month later, in February 1988, the Great Neck Record reported on the 2 community meetings that had taken place. The article also confirmed that the child witnesses had been enrolled in recovered memory therapy sessions at the local hospital, a process now known to cause courtroom testimony to be unreliable and inadmissible, as I previously mentioned. Jesse Friedman notes, which are factually correct, that no child ever made any complaint until the police began interviewing them. Further, many of the same children who would later make accusations had enthusiastically signed up for new courses or had siblings who enrolled on the computer course too. This is after allegedly suffering and witnessing hideous abuse, Jesse points out. Hundreds of normally hypervigilant Great Neck parents picked up seemingly happy children for years, apparently unaware that they had just been sexually abused, Jesse adds. No medical testimony was introduced during the investigation either. One of the parents, whose son was interviewed by the Nassau County Police, covertly recorded one of the police interviews with her son. The recording was handed over to Jesse's lawyer, Peter Panaro. This is a transcript of the recording, read by Panaro himself.
"Detective Hatch, we've had kids who stated that they saw you and that you were involved, okay? Detective Jones, we want to go through this with you. Don't deny it yet. The boy, I didn't see it. I didn't hear it. The boy's mother enters the room and she is asked to leave. Detective Hatch then angrily says, 'You're reasonably intelligent. I wouldn't say you're a genius, but you're reasonably intelligent. Arnold Friedman stipulated in open court that he sodomized a large number of children. Why would Arnold Friedman admit to something that wasn't true?' The boy, 'No, he never touched me.' Detective Hatch, 'Oh, it happened to everyone else, but not to you. How many sessions did you have at Friedman's?' The boy, 8 to 12. Detective Hatch, 'Most people who abuse children have been abused themselves. It's a monster created within you, the little monster inside you, the little voice. Every now and then it rears its ugly head. It's a no-win situation unless the person goes and gets help and admits that he was victimized. Do you remember games of a sexual nature? Stroker? Strip poker? Exploding fist?' The boy, 'Exploding fist was a karate game.' Detective Hatch, 'Did you ever see any porn magazines?' The boy, 'No.' Detective Hatch, 'Did you ever go to any other room in the house?' The boy, 'Yes.' Detective Hatch, 'What room?' The boy, 'Jesse's bedroom to play with the Commodore computer, and nothing happened.' Detective Hatch calls the boy's mother back into the room. When the boy's mother enters the room, Detective Hatch says, 'Your son was a wise guy and I didn't like his answers.'"
So why did Jesse go on Geraldo after his conviction? He's already convicted and in prison. So what does he have to gain? Jesse stated that because he had been found guilty, he felt that by admitting to the crimes and showing remorse, it would gain leniency from the courts and facilitate in part to an early release. But in answering Geraldo's questions, Jesse gives more information regarding the crimes than he is asked, and he goes into far more detail than had been released at the time. The interview was made against the advice of Jesse's lawyer at the time, Peter Panaro, going as far as to sign an affidavit to confirm that he was conducting the interview against his lawyer's wishes. During the interview, Jesse also admits to abusing more children than he was convicted of, and also suffering significant sexual abuse himself at the hands of his father. It really is difficult to know what to believe. Something also left out of the Jarecki documentary was that Jesse had also failed two polygraph tests when questioned about the crimes, and although not admissible in court or deemed 100% accurate, they do shed some light and an interesting point regarding the case. In a 2011 radio interview, Jesse Friedman made the following comments in regards to why he appeared on the Geraldo Rivera show.
My interview with Geraldo was not an honest one per se, at the time. I was resigned to my fate that I was going to be a convicted child molester, and I was going to be going to prison as a child molester. Once you admit your guilt in court, there is no longer anything you can do to say, I didn't do it. The judge was fairly clear that she was going to recommend that I serve all 18 years of my sentence. In order to get paroled, you have to accept responsibility for what you did, and you also have to go for therapy and treatment programs and be rehabilitated. If you don't demonstrate that you're rehabilitated, then they don't release you. So I was basically put in a situation where if I went to the parole board and told them that I didn't do it, here's all the reasons why I didn't do it, all the proof that establishes that I didn't do it, but I had absolutely no choice but to take the plea bargain, because if I had gone to trial and lost, I would have been sentenced to 1,000 years. Like the guy in the cell next to me, they would have simply said that I was in denial and wasn't remorseful and hadn't been rehabilitated, and they weren't going to release me. Now, if I admitted that I did these things, what reason would the parole board have to consider releasing me? Granted, I'll be the first to admit, if there really is someone out there who did the things that I am accused of doing, then they should be kept in prison for a very, very long time. So, what am I supposed to do once I'm put in the situation where I have to plead guilty because it's the only way I'm going to have a chance of a life outside of prison, ever? It's to say that I did it, but there were extenuating circumstances here, and those extenuating circumstances are gone. My father forced me to do it, and it wasn't a voluntary thing, and therefore, since there's no more computer classes, and my father is no longer alive, theoretically, there's no chance of me reoffending because I wasn't doing this of my own volition.
Arlene Epstein, whose son Michael attended the computer classes in which some of the most frequent abuse was alleged to have occurred, kept detailed notes during the investigation period. She still has those notes today. She said that her son adamantly denied any abuse had taken place, and that psychologists and the police had emphasized how important it was for him to come to terms with his abuse and how testifying is a very positive experience that would bring victims enormous relief, the police stated to Michael at the time. Additionally, Michael has told his mother that the only way to satisfy psychologists and the police during the questioning, even though it hadn't happened, was to just accept and admit what they were telling me had happened. Michael never testified in court before the grand jury, it's worth knowing. Ms. Epstein said of the investigation in 1988, quote unquote, it was like there was this very unsanitary breeding pool of false information that was creating this sense of hysteria, close quote. Ultimately, both Arnold and Jesse Friedman signed detailed confessions admitting to all the crimes that they were accused of. From a legal perspective, and from that of a judge or any potential jury, there was no question of their guilt. Jesse Friedman is now 54 years old. He's married and he runs an online bookselling business. He was freed on parole in 2001 after serving 13 years in prison and is now classified for life as a Level 3 violent sex offender. This prohibits him from being near playgrounds, schools, houses of worship, and other places that children may gather. He has maintained his innocence since his release and has appealed the conviction and submitted many motions to have his conviction quashed. The 2011 review of his case was the closest that he came. Responding to a petition by Jesse's legal team, which sought to overturn Jesse Friedman's conviction on the grounds that prosecutors had not turned over material to the defense, the court harshly criticized the child judge, prosecutors, and the police who handled the case. The court said that the evidence in the case against Jesse Friedman was extraordinarily suspect, and that Friedman's guilty plea appeared to have been unlawfully coerced by a biased judge who later repeatedly said in public that she knew Jesse Friedman was guilty before even hearing the evidence. This is quite a statement to make. The court statement went on. The police, prosecutors, and the judge did everything they could to coerce a guilty plea and to avoid a trial. So in November 2010, District Attorney Kathleen Rice announced the Freedman Review Panel, a distinguished panel of experts which would conduct an internal reinvestigation. On June 24, 2013, after 3 years of review, the Nassau County District Attorney, Madeline Singers, releases the Rice Report. Its conclusion states, "The integrity of Jesse Friedman's conviction has not been undermined by allegations of an overzealous investigation and prosecution, or by any new information. After a three-year investigation of the facts and circumstances surrounding Jesse Friedman's guilty plea, the district attorney concludes that Jesse Friedman was not wrongfully convicted." This is not the result that Jesse, his family, filmmaker Andrew Jarecki, Mark Smerling, and all of Friedman's supporters were expecting. In January 2014, pertaining to the unrelated matter of People v. Hamilton, a new legal pathway emerged for Jesse, enabling defendants to have an quote-unquote actual innocence close-quote claim renewed by the court. In June 2015, the Honourable Judge Terence Murphy is assigned to the Friedman evidence hearing. The district attorney at the time states that in order for Friedman to be found actually innocent, he must prove that he is innocent of all crimes to which he was accused. This means Jesse and his legal team must prove that he is innocent of over 300 indictment charges. In June 2018, more than 3.5 years after the actual innocence hearing was granted, the New York Court of Appeals publishes a decision in People v. Tiger. The ruling announces that the right to a hearing under an actual innocence claim is only valid after a conviction at trial and does not include convictions obtained through coerced guilty pleas. Jesse Friedman's conviction still stands to this day, and the evidence both in favour and against his conviction remains substantial. I encourage you all to watch the documentary Capturing the Friedmans in support of this episode and to form your own opinions. Whilst I won't post the link, the movie is available to watch on YouTube for free. Just search Capturing the Friedmans and it should be the first result that comes up. In addition to this, I've added some supplementary material to our website, so if you head over to www.deathcult.com/trial, you can take a look at that too. Finally, get in touch with me and let me know what you think, and if you support Jesse, or if you agree with the authorities on this one. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deathcult.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. There you can also find links to our socials, Patreon, and episodes. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.